gigs like that city traffic, yelling at tourists for lollygagging and making me late for work. I've never to this day had more fun in the business. Becker would come out on triple gigs with me. I was only the opening act, but I'd put Becker on stage in front of me with no permission just so he could get stage time, and all the money we made was communal because Becker's scamming abilities were worth as much as the cash. Becker would buy a video camera so we could film our sets, and he'd go to a place that had a 30 days, no questions asked return policy, and then return it 29 days later.
Was there a problem with the camera, sir?
Well, that's a question. Your sign says no questions asked, and here you are asking me questions. What's with the questions? Listen up, people. Don't buy anything from this store, sir. Don't even think about buying that TV. See that sign? No questions asked. He's asking me questions. It's a bait and switch. It's a bait and switch. I'm never going to shop here again. So obviously Becker would get his refund and then go back the next day to a new place to buy another. Sometimes he'd even go back to the same place and buy another with no questions asked. Fearless. I still envy his balls. We got a single room apartment in a shitty part of Mesa, Arizona, mostly as a place to leave our shit when we were on the road. It was a huge apartment complex that looked like the projects. I found that a lot in the Southwest, that the buildings all look so similar, all cookie cutter, beige brown or salmon stucco, be it a gated community or a public housing, that you don't know a bad neighborhood until it's too late. We knew this complex was a ghetto immediately, but the price was right. The building manager walked us to this second-story unit that we'd be renting alongside the courtyard, complete with a greenish, algae-ridden pool. Becker says, "Oh, look, we're right over the pool. I guess that means we're going to be testifying in court a lot." And then she showed us the place. Searching for any selling point at all, she mentions the cabinets have just been painted. A closer look showed a cockroach on the edge of a cabinet door that had been left and painted over, possibly while still alive. We signed the lease on the spot. We knew comedy. Everything horrible in life was money in the bank when you put it on stage.
Eventually, I had enough work to where I didn't need to keep coming back to Arizona. In December of 1991, I packed my shit into my car and headed out on the road. Like I had in L.A., I got a voicemail service and a mailing service, so I had a permanent number and address. I'd call in for messages using prepaid phone cards and have my mail forwarded any time it stacked up and I was somewhere on the road long enough to collect it. If I had days or weeks that I couldn't fill with a gig, there was always a comedian, a waitress, or a fan from the audience willing to put you up. That's the great thing about being young and following your dreams. People are excited for you. They want to encourage you, help you out, and send you off with a sack lunch. If I were 47 and living out of my car, people couldn't sprint away from me fast enough. I lived out of my car for 3 years, almost to the day, or I should say 6 or 7 different cars. They'd break down, and if it were serious, it was usually cheaper to dump it and buy a new piece of shit than to fix it. I couldn't call mother for money anymore. She'd pissed all hers away and was living paycheck to paycheck, the same as me. I had Dad's credit card number written on the back of a business card for emergencies. That saved my ass on many occasions. One Christmas, he came out on the road with me for a week. We were driving on barren two-lane stretches between Rock Springs, Wyoming, and Montana. I don't think there is a more desolate stretch of road in the country. We were dead in the middle when the snow started coming down in a wall. I could tell my dad was scared shitless. "Geez, guy, what would you do if you ever broke down out here?" "I don't know, Dad. That's usually when I call you." For the most part, those years of gigs were at the lowest level of stand-up comedy that still paid money. If you've seen Jeff Bridges at the beginning of Crazy Heart, staying in a ramshackle motel, drinking alone, and playing to hayseeds at the roadhouse across the street, That's a pretty good representation. I loved every minute of it. I never worried about my status in the industry, never even considered it. I was making a living on stage. I was getting girls, some of them not even that ugly. I never had to pay for a drink unless I sucked. That was the only incentive I had to maintain any professionalism. I was better than most of the other guys working shit gigs in hotel lounges. That was my only barometer of quality. There was no thought of a bigger picture. This was more than I could have ever hoped for.
Hey, listen. You're the only person listening to this audiobook at all. This is between me and you. So don't tell anyone how it ends. Chapter next. Chapter 14. Moving on up. By 1995, I was working pretty steady, mostly because I wasn't picky, and generally, I was rarely an asshole. People forget that it's important to be a decent guy. A lot of the gigs were terrible, but those are the ones that made the best stories. I'd moved up to headline and one-nighters, and I was a middle act in real comedy clubs. But still, I took any shit gig I could get just to fill in the holes. At one point, Becker and I took a gig on a tour bus taking blue-haired elderly people from Minneapolis to the local Indian casino 45 minutes out of town. I was booked on the first gig. Becker came along for the ride. He was booked the next week. And when I walked onto the tour bus, I sank into immediate terror. Save for the driver and the tour director, there wasn't anyone on that bus younger than 70 years old. And to make things worse, the seats were all facing each other with tables in between, so half the people had their backs to you. And the microphone played over the bus's loudspeaker, and I turned to Becker and I begged him under my breath to take my place. Please go first. Even my cleanest material had no relevance to these ancient relics. At least Becker had jokes, but he flat out refused. He knew watching me eat shit was worth way more money than they were paying for me to do this gig. So as the bus started up, the tour guide piped up like Julie from the Love Boat and announced that everyone was in for a treat. We have entertainment on this bus. Ha, 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 ha. And I leaned into Becker and I said, fuck you. Keep count. And I told him I'm going to give him $5 for every one of his jokes that I did. And I proceeded to do Becker's entire act on that tour bus. So it's hard to say exactly who died on their ass that night. At some point early that year, I was working a shithole dance club in Pueblo, Colorado as an opening act, $125 in a room. You weren't going to get rich and you weren't going to get famous, so all you could hope for was to get laid. Problem here was the people at this gig didn't give a fuck about comedy. They were slowly filtering in as the show went on, patiently waiting for you to shut the fuck up and finish so they could line dance, which happened after the show. Me being the opener, you're waiting for the headliner to shut the fuck up so you can work the few chicks that actually saw you on stage. I'd lost a contact lens at some point a few weeks earlier, and rather than dip into beer money, I'd been surviving on only one contact, and even poor vision couldn't make the ladies look good that night in Pueblo. That night, the headliner's manager, Judy Brown, who was from Colorado, was in the audience. And after the show, she asked me if I wanted to participate in the fledgling Vail Invitational Comedy Competition. It's a competition she's running. They're having regional competitions around the country with top comics advancing to the semifinals in Colorado. There's promises of big-time agents and network execs and exposure and all the bullshit. And I was skeptical, but I had nothing to lose. And I was on my way to Minneapolis anyway, where there was a regional set at an Indian casino. So I signed up, just hoping it wasn't the same audience from that fucking tour bus. Next morning in Pueblo, I was woken up by the local programming director of the radio station who had sponsored the show. She wanted to take me to breakfast before I left town. I was hungover like a pirate. I opened the door, flopped back face down on the bed, groaning at the light, and she went to the sink, emptied a water glass to rinse out to bring me a fresh glass of water to hydrate me. And it was a minute before I realized that glass had my sole contact lens soaking in saline solution. She dumped my only contact lens down the drain. I had to drive 1,000 miles from Pueblo to Minnesota, squinting like Mr. Magoo, blind as a shrimp. I won the regional competition at the Indian Casino. Just took off my glasses. I keep doing that. Like it's gonna, I'm just annoyed with my fucking reading glasses. And I realize I need them a million times in this fucking book. I've taken off my reading glasses because they annoy my face. And then I go, oh wait, that's what I'm doing for a living. It's like the fucking guy in South Africa. You know what? I'm going to run without this fucking spring. Oops. That's why he killed his wife. Frustration. Please hold. I won the regional competition. I won something like $500 and a pager. Really was a pager. They made a big deal about it. And then I went to the semifinals in Boulder, Denver, Canyon City, Colorado, Colorado Springs, and then back to Pueblo. I got to work with some of the funniest comics I'd ever met. When you do triple gigs, you work with guys on their last lungs. In Vail, I worked with Jim Norton, Derek Edwards from Canada, infamous road lunatics like James Inman and J. Scott Homan. I presumptively flew Mother out there to see me take the crown. Neither of us really cared when I didn't even make it to the finals. The comics like me that didn't advance still got to do sets at Vail. And as promised, there was industry there and I got noticed. But I had a little or no idea what to say to the suits. I was a dude who lived out of his car and spewed filth at saloon audiences. I'm not Hollywood savvy. I didn't have a sitcom idea or a screenplay I was working on. They asked me what I wanted to do with my career, and I thought, I'm already doing it. I didn't know. All they want to hear is, I'm moving to Los Angeles. They'll tell you what you want to do with your career once you get there. Mother had seen me perform once or twice before, but nothing on a scale like this. The stink of chasing the big break was all over the place. Most of the comics were frantic to get noticed. I was stupefied just being in the scene. Mother shined. She was a cocky, arrogant ball buster. I remember she was sitting around a lounge table of suits and comics when someone brought out a plate of oysters, and she picked one up with her fork and said, "Look, Pussy Del Mar! That means of the sea." She claimed her status as comedy mom to all the comedians, and nobody balked. She wasn't wowed by the industry. They'd say, "You know you have a really funny son." And she'd say, "No shit, Sherlock." There was a management couple, Mark Lano and Joanne Astro, and they blew the largest plumes of smoke up my ass. And I liked them because they didn't seem desperate. As much as every comic wanted to stand out, I could see the same thing in how the industry big timers needed to look important. I remember one suit, he was either manager or agent to comedian Tim Allen, who was huge on TV at the time. And I remember that dude sitting outside the hotel one afternoon where all the comics were hanging out, having a very loud cell phone conversation with Tim Allen. We knew this because he kept using Tim Allen's full name to Tim Allen while he talked to Tim Allen about Tim Allen and Tim Allen's career. Mark and Joanne had none of these bullshit airs about them. They seemed just as happy to be there as I was, and if something were to be gained, so be it. They were a couple who managed a few comedians. Mark Lanau was partners with Bud Friedman in the improv comedy club chain. And Mark and Joanne raved about me to me, which is always awkward, but better than the opposite. To listen to them, you'd think I was going to be flying out of there on a Learjet. I didn't care if they were lying. I had nothing for them to take. They wanted to manage me. I had no idea what that entailed, but I couldn't see how it was bad. They took me out to some gothic, upscale, wild game restaurant, and we ate buffalo, and we ate boar, we ate quail. I'd never been to a restaurant where they actually had someone taste the wine before they served it. That shit only happened in movies. The bill had to be in the hundreds of dollars. I couldn't imagine spending that much on a meal. That's what I spent on a car. There was no way I'd be signing with anyone else at this point. The meal had already paid for itself before I even had dessert. Now I could forgive Mother for missing that one amazing catch I made playing football back in Paxton so many years ago, because she was there in Vail when all the hype actually materialized in slow motion. And all while she was paying attention and cheering for me, not looking away because she was afraid I'd get hurt. Joanne Astro flew out to meet me on the road a few weeks later at a comedy club in Wichita, Kansas, to sign the contract. She seemed amused at the abject destitution of the road. She'd done stand-up comedy for a minute, but I don't think she'd ever seen the road like this. It was like Hollywood sent in a Navy SEAL team to save me. Few months later in the summer, same people held the Vail Comedy Festival. Same shit without the competition. Just shows in front of industry, only now I had management to field the questions I didn't know the answers to. Agents and networks were waiting to meet me. Mother was waiting by the phone to hear what they said. I signed with APA as my agent, and they told me HBO wanted to sign a development deal with me. At the same time, the San Francisco Comedy Competition had just accepted my entry for the fall. Unlike Vail, San Francisco was a pedigreed comedy competition of legend. Even if its most iconic years were behind it, it was still the biggest comedy competition in the country. There was no doubt now I'd be moving to L.A. I made a few forays in over the summer. I was still living out of my car. But in L.A., there's always a place to crash. Comedy clubs were like AA meetings in that you always had some kind of disjointed family you could find in any city. And every comic eventually winds up in L.A. I'd have pointless meetings with networks and lunches with agents. Agents love to have lunch. That's what they do. Nothing's ever accomplished, but they always picked up the tab. And I'd grown my mullet out into full rock and roll hair, sitting on Sunset Boulevard with my sunglasses on, listening to agents and managers tell me how big I was going to be, just sitting there and waiting to cash the big check.
Hey, while I was reading this book on tape, I was supposed to be writing material for my new tour, which I didn't do because I was reading this book on tape. Don't see me on tour anytime soon. Now, Chad Shank.
I was standing at the bar, the Improv Comedy Club on Melrose in West Hollywood. It was August of 1995. Barry Katz was and is a legendary comedy manager. I'd met him at the Vail Festival. He was tall and gangly with long hair and a hook nose, like a blonde Howard Stern. He told me I was going to be a big star. He said he could always tell. I passed him at the bar at the Improv and he stopped me. He said he'd heard I was going to be doing the San Francisco competition. I said that I was. One of my guys is doing it too. You want to bet prize money against him? His guy was Dane Cook, a comedian client of his who I'd never heard of. Nobody had heard of either of us at that point. I declined the bet, which was silly anyway. The competition was a month long with 40 comedians. The chances of either of us even being in the top five to get prize money was a long shot. I'd been staying with Mitch Hedberg and his girlfriend Jana Johnson since I'd moved there. Mitch and I had originally bonded over an insane acid trip in Minneapolis when we first worked together at Knuckleheads Comedy Club at the Mall of America a few years before, and had worked together a bunch more over the years. He'd moved to LA shortly before me and was starting to get noticed. He was doing the San Francisco competition too. The competition was split into two groups of 20. The top five from each of the first 2 weeks would go on to the semifinals. The top five from that week on to the finals. Mitch and I were in the first week, along with Dane Cook. The first night of the first week of shows took place at the Punchline Comedy Club in San Francisco. Mitch and I both had decent sets, but didn't make the top five. Dane Cook placed second for the night. First place was taken by a girl who pretended to be deaf. It was a character she did regularly, but in a short set, she never broke character. If the comics weren't crying foul, they were murmuring it. Mitch and I were drunk and dejected. We talked about quitting right there and not even finishing the competition at all. I passed Barry Katz at the bar. I was pie-eyed and irritable. "Aren't you glad you didn't bet me prize money now?" he said, with his easily imitable drawn-out sneer. "You know what? Fuck you. I'll bet you $100 I win this whole fucking thing regardless of your guy." I was enveloped in false bravado. "You don't want to make that bet." I kept my hand out until he shook it. I had the rest of the week to make it up, and I did. Mitch didn't make it out of the first round, but it didn't matter. There wasn't a comedian there who didn't see that Mitch was miles beyond us, including Mitch. When he learned that he was mathematically eliminated before the last show of the week, he just went on stage and did his act until the light went on that told you your time was up. The second the light went on, he just stopped talking in mid-sentence and leave the stage. Brilliant. The San Francisco comedy competition was legendary for the people who had done it in the past. Dana Carvey, Ellen DeGeneres, and Kevin Pollak had all been previous winners or finalists. Robin Williams came in second place in its inaugural year in 1975. But those days were gone, and the luster of the competition had worn off. This was their 20th anniversary. The winner still got $10,000, but nobody in the business really gave much of a fuck anymore. But I gave a fuck now. I bet $100 talking out of my ass, and I wanted that $100 more than the $10,000 or the benign accolades. The rest of the competition went like a script. Dane Cook and me neck and neck throughout, all the way to the finals. One of the nights was at Harris Casino in Reno. After the show, a few of us were going to go to a titty bar. I asked Dane if he wanted to come along. He declined, saying he was going to his room to work on his set. What is wrong with this guy? Going to the titty bar is working on your set. And for me, it pretty much was. Honestly, my material was shit at that point, but I allowed myself to riff a lot, and that made all the difference. Anything you could come up with about the town, the venue, the other comics, or the night before that made it seem real and loose made all the difference. It gave the illusion that it was not packaged, not an act. The competition was grueling, and not just on stage. You weren't getting paid, and aside from that night in Reno, you didn't get a hotel. There was plenty to riff on with just sleeping in your car and taking sink showers. Having 19 other comics in the back of the room was like having a whole second audience to add laughs to your show if you could play to both. During an off night the first week, Mitch and I went to a comedy club in the East Bay where his friend Arj Barker was scheduled to MC. The show was about to start and Arj still wasn't there. He'd been caught in traffic. They asked Mitch and me if one of us would cover for him, saying it would pay $50. We both knew we needed the money, so rather than draw straws, we went up together as the comedy team of Arj and Barker. Fuck it, his name was already on the marquee. We knew each other's acts well enough that we could just set each other up in silly vaudeville style.
"Hello, I'm Arj."
"And I'm Barker."
"And together we're the comedy duo of
Arj and Barker." "Hey, Arj, I hear that you don't like it when people hand you flyers."
"Yeah, Barker. It's like they're saying, here, you throw this away."
$25 each, free drinks, and I went home with the single mom bartender. One more night without having to sleep in my car. If Dane Cook and I had anything in common, it was that we were both mama's boys. Every night after a show, we'd invariably wind up at the same bank of payphones, calling our mothers to tell them how we did. It was always awkward for one of us. Whoever had placed higher that night had to muffle his conversation so as not to be bragging in the other guy's face. We were civilized in that manner, but it was clear that we were rivals, and by the finals, it was clear that Dane Cook wasn't going away easily. The last night of the finals week was held at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. I'd bought a suit, tie, and shoes at a thrift store for a total of $16. I got there early and did what every comic had been doing before and after shows for the last month, annoying the scorekeeper. Scoring the competition was a series of convoluted arithmetic, dropping highest and lowest scores from each night and averaging the rest. The scorekeeper had left his book open in the green room, and I started crunching the numbers. I went over them repeatedly, and even with my cruddy math skills, it kept coming up the same result. Mathematically, I was a lock. I couldn't be beaten. My pulse went batshit. I pointed this out to John Fox, who ran the competition. He looked at the numbers. He balked and evaded giving me a straight answer. He said it looked good for me, but that anything could still happen. I went through the numbers again like a defense attorney, demanding he admit that I had already won. He wouldn't say. I thought of the Yugo I was supposed to win at Midwest Enterprises. I knew that some fix was in, and I was about to get robbed again. I crushed on stage from what I remember. Or maybe I didn't. My nerves were so haywire, and I was so worn down that it was as blurry as a fistfight. Backstage was the gallows waiting for the scores to be tallied. Each comic telling the other how good they did, hoping the judges didn't agree. They announced the finalists in order. It got down to me and Dane Cook waiting in the wings for first and second. I looked at my feet, pacing in small circles. And in second place, Dane Cook! I fucking won! I fucking won, and these cocksuckers knew I'd won the whole night and wouldn't tell me. I'd spent the last 3 hours with acid burning through my guts, thinking I was about to get railroaded. I wished I'd never looked at the numbers. Instead of a victory, I felt like I'd been exonerated of a crime I didn't commit. Sure, I was happy to have a ruling in my favor, but it didn't feel like I'd hit the lottery. I felt like I'd broken even. In hindsight, they did the right thing in not telling me. I could have easily walked out on stage and taken a shit in a wine glass as my act, knowing I couldn't lose. And there'd be no thrill in announcing the final five in order if it was already known backstage. But even realizing that, the truth was there was an emptiness in winning that final night. They had champagne in the green room and four other spent comics offering me sad congratulations. There was nobody to celebrate with. I hated that night. I'd known going in that all competitions were bullshit, that it was just a lottery based on the opinions of random judges, most of whom had nothing to do with the business, radio DJs and newspaper entertainment column hacks. But it really sunk in afterwards in that green room. I've always felt a special kinship with comedians. A cliche, yes, but they really are family. Those years on the road where it's just you and one or two other comics against one hostile audience after another, you made friends and bonded very quickly. Even if you didn't like each other or laugh at their material, you had each other's backs. Pitted against one another in a competition made for a really shitty climax. You wanted to beat the audience, not each other. I wanted to apologize to the other comics, not high-five an empty victory. I drank my champagne, got my check, and got the fuck out. The party didn't start until I called Mother. I probably cried on the phone to her, but then again, eat a pail of shit. I left my car at the theater and went to the Punchline Comedy Club where I could gloat outside earshot of my competitors. Beers poured and shots flew. I woke up in bed with a waitress I didn't know. I'd left my car on the street at the theater, which was now a tow zone after 7 a.m. Seeing it was well past 7 a.m., I ran out without waking her up and flagged down a cab. The relief of seeing that my car was still at the theater was quickly erased when I saw that it had been broken into. Someone smashed out the back window and stole everything I owned. I stood there, reeking of booze and strange pussy, still wearing my $16 suit with a check for $10,000 in my coat pocket, wishing there was someone with me to share the surreal moment. I called Mother again with my new development. She would listen to my story so enraptured that it made me want to fuck up even more just to entertain her. She couldn't believe my luck, the seeming insanity of it all, and that I just seemed to skate through adversity time after time. I think I needed to see it through her eyes to make it all real, or unreal maybe. If it was all an incredible movie to her, it could be to me as well. She was my rock and my muse and my only fan that mattered. Of course I called my dad, but he didn't quite get it. He'd come to my shows both in Worcester and out on the road a few times. He didn't get the jokes, but he liked seeing other people laugh at them. "They really seem to enjoy the heck out of you," he'd say. I called to tell him I'd won in San Francisco. He thought that was just great. I tried to explain to him the lore of the competition. He didn't know stand-up comedy from marching bands or extracurricular pussy. I knew he'd at least be aware of the extremely famous Robin Williams. To try to give him some scope of what I'd just won, I explained that Robin Williams had done the first ever SFCC and only come in second place. He thought that was just great. It wouldn't be until years later that I found out he'd been telling everyone in the family I'd just beaten Robin Williams in a comedy contest. The most important call I made that morning was to the office of Barry Katz. "Congratulations," were the first thing out of his mouth. "I want my $100," was the first thing out of mine. I think he thought I was kidding. I wasn't. It took me a year and 3 different payments to collect it from him, but eventually I got it in full. I'd have framed it if it hadn't come in so many small bills. Dane Cook became my official comedy adversary in those weeks of the competition. I didn't like his comedy much, but it was never personal. Everyone laughs at different shit. He became my go-to reference for hokey stand-up long before anyone really knew who he was. In fact, what bothered me most about his rise to fame and subsequent backlash was that I felt robbed by people jumping on my bandwagon. I hated Dane Cook back when he was just a garage comic. Dane was also now Mother's arch rival, but she took it seriously and never let it go. For years after, you'd hear her say, "I saw that fucking Dane Cook on TV. He's fucking awful. I can't believe these fucking people think he's funny," to the point that I'd end up having to defend him. The Yankees don't hate the Red Sox as people, Ma. I like to hate Dane Cook, but it isn't personal. It was just fun to have a nemesis. Mother acted like he'd molested me as a child. On December 13th, 1995, I officially moved to L.A., almost 3 years to the day that I began living out of my car.
While you sit in your day bed with your feet over the bed rungs and you're 51 years old and you don't have a job and you sit there with the earbuds in listening to this audiobook, remember, you're a fucking loser. You're not getting anything done by listening to this audiobook. And your friend, who you haven't known since community college, he said, "Yeah, you can stay here for a couple of nights. You've been there for a month and a half. You have no intentions of leaving. Yeah, there's another chapter coming. But maybe instead, you should get out and get a fucking job. Here's the next chapter."
Chapter 15, The Big Time. I stayed with Mitch and Jana in their West Hollywood apartment for a little while I looked for a place of my own. Jana said she had a friend who had a place opening up in her building just a few blocks away and that it was rent control. To this day, I still have no idea what rent controlled means legally, but I know it equals cheap as fuck. I looked at the place. It was a one-bedroom, walking distance to all the comedy clubs right in West Hollywood, and it was only $410 a month. I gave him 6 months up front just to secure it. Between the thrift stores and the dollar store, I was set up in days. I had a TV, a VCR, a bed, a chair, and a desk. I had my own food and my own refrigerator. I had $14,000 in the bank. There was nothing else I needed. Nothing else I wanted. So there was nothing to spend it on, which made it momentarily seem worthless. It was a disquieting moment of clarity. How can you go from splitting a $50 gig with Hedberg out of sheer necessity
to having 14 grand in the bank that quickly and be depressed about it. The reason cigarettes are so fulfilling is you know you're going to need another one soon afterwards, and you're going to be able to fulfill that need immediately. The reason I drink coffee in the morning is not to wake up. It's because I know it's going to make me want a cigarette, and I'm going to be able to fulfill that desire. What good's a cigarette if you don't feel like you need it? Having everything I needed there in LA made me feel complacent and dull in that moment. I was scared and I was out of my element, but I'd adapt. Because LA has a way of making you feel like you need shit. Mother had been in Florida for over 10 years at this point, and that's going to take a toll on a person. Florida's good for no more than 4 days. I put in enough time there to know. I saw her there a few times in early 1996 doing college gigs that I was completely ill-suited for. Colleges prefer clean, goofy acts for those young students who still had hopes and dreams. Mother drove down when I played with Mitch on my birthday in 1996 at the University of South Florida, and later by myself at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona. The Embry-Riddle gig was in a cafeteria during dinner where nobody even seemed to know they were having a comedy show. Students just loaded their trays full of gruel, which they devoured, and occasionally they might look up. Mother was the only laugh to be heard, exaggerated and screeching through the silence, always followed by her hacking smoker's cough. I loved that cough. She'd had it since we were kids. I could find her in the grocery store by listening for it like a rescue beacon. Now I could find the only person enjoying the show by listening for that cough. One person laughing is way worse than nobody laughing. Your mother being the only person laughing is humiliating. But the check was good and we ran like thieves back to Crystal River. Mother never saw a Doug Stanhope show she didn't love. She'd gone back to nursing school and she'd blown off my brother's wedding for her own graduation. She couldn't miss any kind of spotlight. For the graduation, she dressed up as an old woman with a fake colostomy bag, spilling it all over herself and other students. Would have been way funnier if she'd had done that at the wedding, but it was funny still. Now she's actually working as a nurse and hating every minute of it. All the same shit from her bartending days. Always someone was a cunt. Always somebody else she couldn't work with. She was making Michael's life miserable too, constantly trashing him for simply being himself. He couldn't do anything right. If you didn't do exactly what Mother would do, you were an asshole, unless you were me. Mother was also becoming racist, or at least speaking their language. We'd watch the news and she'd mutter, "fucking niggers," under her breath. This was the polar opposite of the mother that raised us. I didn't know if being married to a cop was what started this, but Michael never showed any sign of being anything but a fat, sweet, lazy dude, incapable or too lazy to hate anyone. Mother defended herself with rhetoric that belied her intelligence, basically using the Chris Rock bit that there were black people and that there were niggers, only without the rational, funny parts. I knew the difference between black people and niggers. One of those words Mother would have slapped me in the face for saying when I was a kid, unless I made it funny. In short, Mother seemed to hate every single thing in the world except me. She loved me to the point that it was uncomfortable sometimes, like I was the only thing in her life that was good. She made no secret she was living her life vicariously through me. And even though there was a certain sadness to that, it still stroked my newly emboldened ego that I was something to be admired. She visited LA just after that trip for the first time. I brought her to the Improv, my new home, and they treated her like royalty. She fell right back into the life of the party like she had in Vail. Agents and managers took us to lunches and dinners, and I wasn't embarrassed when she stole Sweet and Low packages off the table. You picture your grandmother doing that. Mother was only 50. She was younger than even my managers. Fuck it, steal away, lady. These other people picking up the tab are all interchangeable out here anyway. I had a gig booked in Santa Ana and talked her into opening for me as herself, as my mother. She had done plays, so she was game as long as I wrote her what to say. She went up with this, very bashful and demure. "Hello, boys and girls. I'm Bonnie, and I'm Doug Stanhope's mother. Are you looking forward to the show? Well, I just want you to know that if you're not familiar with my son's act, he does have a bit of a potty mouth. And he does have a tendency to sometimes go into the gutter. So I just want you to know that he was raised in a good, wholesome, middle-class environment with my good values and morals. So if at any point you're offended during his act, it shouldn't be a reflection on me." At this point, Mother dropped the sweet act and started cranking up the vitriol into a lather. "If you want someone to blame, try that dip-fuck father of his. That stupid asshole's idea of discipline was, here's a Tootsie Pop, don't do it again. What the fuck is that? I'm trying to bring up wholesome, upstanding children, and this pansy-ass cocksucker just lets them do any goddamn thing they want to. He wanted to be pals with his children. Well, get this, pally boy. Check out the foul goddamn mouth on this son of a bitch, you bastard. Are you happy now, you rotten prick?" And now into full spitting hatred. "So if any of you sniveling douchebags came here looking for a family show, don't get pissed off at me. I'll give you his father's number and you can call that motherfucker collect." Then back to catching herself for a beat. And then going back to adorable. "But it's all in good fun, so are you ready for a good show? Let's hear it for little Dougie Stanhope." She destroyed, and she couldn't ask enough times how well she did. Every compliment was like a drop of water in drought-stricken soil. Back at the improv a few nights later, I saw Barry Katz at the bar. He still owed me money for the Dane Cook bet. I'd caught him once there and asked for my $100. He said he only had 40. I said I'd take it, but that he still owed me. This night, I had mother work collections. Hi, I'm Doug Stanhope's mother, and he says you owe him $60. I only have 20. She took it. I laughed from across the room as he fumbled through his wallet. I got the last 40 the next time I saw him there. I'm surprised he hadn't just stopped going to the improv altogether to get out of paying. Mother had a blast in L.A., save for the traffic, which horrified her into clutching at the dashboard and constantly pumping her imaginary passenger side brakes. She loved being recognized and congratulated, if just for being my mom. Like everyone else in L.A., she again took all the credit she could. But she deserved it. She went back to Florida. Michael got fired from the sheriff's department for some trumped-up bullshit that I never really got the full story on. They divorced shortly afterwards. I still really don't know why, but nobody was surprised. I think he'd had an affair. God knows he deserved one after all the shit he took from her. Mother had a good way of running people out of her life. Meanwhile, between gigs on the road, I floated around L.A. waiting for this famous shit to happen. I did a million showcases for the Suits. Showcases are live stand-up comedy shows where the audience is monopolized by industry people looking at new talent. I did showcases for networks, for festivals, for late-night shows. I remember doing a showcase for the Letterman people. And afterwards, the Letterman booker told my manager, "Yeah, he's really funny, but the Doug Flutie's flipper baby bit isn't going to be on Letterman anytime soon." There was a lot of places my jokes weren't going to be appropriate. Still, I did get a small development deal with HBO's production arm, which had just put out Everybody Loves Raymond. Development deals work in that they give you a chunk of money to develop a sitcom for network television. Hedberg had just got one for $500,000. Mine was only $15,000 with another $30,000 for a half-hour HBO special to be taped the next year. I wasn't complaining. The worst that could happen is it all went in the sewer and I went back to being happy living out of my car. If I didn't have confidence, I had low standards and apathy down pat. Hollywood moves slow as milk spit and I wasn't in a hurry. You get a deal and then you wait forever while agents and lawyers and managers finger-fuck the details. Everyone's always get a call into so-and-so and waiting to hear back on such-and-such, and then you'll be famous. Take your time, I'll grab a drink. L.A. wasn't home until Mitch and I found our own bar, the Coach and Horses on Sunset, only a couple of blocks from where we lived. We'd walk past it all the time, but it seemed sleazy and possibly dangerous, even by our low standards. It was open, but you almost never saw people coming in and out of it. And when you did, they looked like hobos or old war veterans. One day, bored, we mustered up some courage and ventured in. Ginger, the bartender, was a bedraggled woman between 60 and 75 who looked homeless and talked like Mama from Throw Mama from the Train. She was mean like a wounded animal, and the bar was empty because of it. She'd evidently worked there for 17 years, and the owner was too much of a drunk to bother with the trouble of replacing her. We'd hear legendary stories, like her throwing a blind man out for having a dog. When one of the few regulars tried to explain the situation, that he was blind and that was a seeing eye dog, she screamed, "I don't care, the sign says no dogs!" I don't doubt the story. I was there one day when the guy next to me at the bar was talking to his friend. Ginger picked up his empty bottle and mumbled a hate-filled, "You want another?" When he politely said he was fine for right now, she shrieked, "This isn't a bus stop!" I still use that one today when people aren't keeping up with my drinking. Ginger became our unrequited soulmate simply because she was insane, and we made the Coach our regular bar. Anyone who dared come in, we were friendly with, since it was always ugly and mostly empty. That made it an easy target for people who didn't want to be seen. Michael Keaton came in a few times, Kiefer Sutherland on other occasions. Mitch and I bought shots for Quentin Tarantino one desolate afternoon. We didn't know what being that guy was. We just recognized him and thought that was a good enough reason to drink Jägermeister at 4 p.m. Not everybody has a life that allows them to drink Jägermeister with Tarantino in the middle of the day. We owed it to those people.
Ron Zimmerman was a writer and a drinker I knew as a regular at the Improv Bar. He was also a poon hound. One night at the bar, he asked me if I wanted to be set up on a blind date. In return, he wanted me to set him up with one of my lady comedian friends. Any one of them. He was friends with a girl who had been a child star on a show called Head of the Class. He said she was a tall redhead who'd been one of People magazine's 50 most beautiful people. He told me she drove an $80,000 Corvette. He thought we'd hit it off. I couldn't understand why he'd think someone like that would have anything to do with someone like me. I didn't consider he just wanted me to set him up on an equal level. Maybe he'd been shopping this blind date to anyone he thought had hot friends. Didn't cross my mind. Didn't matter. I said, absolutely. Becker had come through town and was staying with me for a while. Everyone stays with you for a while if you live in L.A. and have a couch. Some will stay forever if you let them. That's why I tell comics in L.A. never to own a couch. Get a love seat. They will develop scoliosis before you ever have to tell them to leave. I told Becker about my blind date. I had no idea where to take a girl like this. I had no idea what to even say to a girl like this. Becker and I plotted out a plan of action. My car was a 1984 Olds Cutlass I referred to as the pig that always seemed to be on its last legs. It was the same car that had been broken into in San Francisco, now with ratty duct tape where the window had been. It just wouldn't die. On one of my rare gigs in the Southeast a couple years previous, I'd visited Mother. The pig was going through a quart of oil every couple of fill-ups. I mentioned it to Mother and Mike, and they sent me to their mechanic. He took a look at it and told me that it was leaking oil from every possible place a car could leak oil. The mechanic advised that I should just drive it into the ground and be done with it. I left town and it never leaked oil again. For the date, I decided that, if nothing else, I should put new duct tape over the smashed out window on the off chance I had to drive. That's how you spruce up for a date with a hot celebrity. New duct tape on your car window.
All right, I'm with Matt Becker right now, and first of all, the pig that we dolled up with the brand new duct tape was a legendary warhorse vehicle that we still had New Mexico plates. So it was easier because California,
is complicated and it's expensive.
All, you got to get smog inspected.
Yeah. Which that car was never going to do that.
Not a chance.
It was the XM Valdez as far as oil spills.
So it was easier when the registration was up to drive, you know, 15 hours to New Mexico and get a, you know, get new tags. They don't Gallup, New Mexico. They don't give a fuck about smog.
So we were like, road trip.
Yeah. And we get our new tags and we came back with the pig, literally just back from New Mexico with new tags. Now we're legal.
We're going to the improv.
Yeah.
And so we get cleaned up after our 15-hour road trip.
Each way.
Yeah. And so we get showered, changed. We're going to improv. We're feeling great about life. We go down, get in the car.
Take Doug a left had, on Fairfax.
Yeah, but Doug had just put the tag on the back of the license, so now it's current. We go take a left on Fairfax. Woo!
Get pulled over. And the reason they said they pulled us over is because we have no front license plate. But they didn't tell us that until first passenger, get out of the vehicle.
Raise your hands.
Walk backwards. Mm-hmm. Get us on the sidewalk, pinned down with our fucking hands on the back of our heads. And then tell us, well, you have no front license plate. I go, it's in New Mexico. They don't have front license plates. You should know that. That's your job to know.
Yeah, which we were a little nicer than that, but yeah.
Yeah.
After rolling around on the ground, they made us lay on the ground and roll over. And we're like, it's our only clean shirts. We just showered.
We were just so happy to finally be legal, and now we're out with our fucking doing some kind of fucking perp walk.
But we always did the thing. Our worst luck is still our best luck. It was like we just put the tags on. You'd have gotten ticketed up the ass if you didn't have those two tags on.
Yeah. He said, well, the 84 Olds Cutlass is evidently a common gangbanger car, but they couldn't figure out that we weren't gangbangers by my fucking mullet.
Yeah, we did smell like Mexican urine.
And your slap happy t-shirt.
Yeah, I had a slap happy t-shirt on, that's right. But yeah, I think we're getting the light. Time to cancel the act. But so we go to the improv that night, though. So we get through that, and we're giddy about getting away with nothing. And we get to the improv, and they have a huge windstorm that night. And as the wind was blowing and everything, the improv sign from the Melrose Improv blew off.
Plexiglass, you know, this outside sign blew off and shattered on the sidewalk.
While everyone else is running the other way to the disaster, only Doug would run towards the disaster, grab a huge chunk of the improv sign and go, I want to be this. He ran and put it in the car and we drove away with our legal plate.
You grabbed the biggest piece of the improv sign, and it's still to this day on my kitchen wall.
Yep.
It says, Mrov. Half an M.
Yep.
And now back to the book.
Coming up with no ideas on where to take her, I finally just told her to meet me at the Coach and Horses and we'd take it from there. I got there plenty early to drink up my swagger.
Sidebar. Earlier, a couple paragraphs ago, I gave Hedberg credit for buying shots for Tarantino. But 4 o'clock in the afternoon, but it turns out that was Becker. So yeah, I fucked up a few facts and details.
Well, I mean, I'm here to correct it, so it's good. So, but yeah, and I just remember how giddy you were about putting new duct tape on your window, because that was like the classier part of the date.
And resume.
I took two seats at the door end of the bar. Evan was a regular at the bar and was sitting on the corner across from me. She was the kind of dive bar regular that only exists in movies. She was tall, Nordic blonde, and gorgeous if somewhat weather-worn. She was only 29, but carried herself like she'd been drinking alone at the same bar stool for just as many years. Sometimes I'd come in during the day and she'd be sitting in her usual spot at the far end of the bar, chain-smoking Carlton 100s and drinking Miller Lite. I'd come back after shows late that night and she was still in the same spot, still drinking, no worse for the wear. There was always something about her that was unapproachable. The fact that nobody else at the bar ever seemed to hit on her, an otherwise sitting duck in a bar full of predators, confirmed this. This night was the first time she wasn't down in her regular seat and the first time I talked to her. I told her about this famous girl I was supposed to meet, that I was nervous and out of my league. She gave me shit and goofed on me for even caring. She was childlike in her cruelty. I needed the abuse. I needed the beer even more. Panic drinking. Christine walked into this landfill bar like it was a red carpet. I didn't need any social skills. She had them all. I asked her what she wanted to drink, and my soul sunk when she said she didn't really drink. Evan rolled her eyes behind Christine's back and tried not to laugh at me audibly. We never left the place. We sat and talked while I got progressively more intoxicated, and somehow everything seemed to go fantastically. She was verbose and fun, and she didn't seem to care that I was piling down beers and shots like it was the eve of Prohibition. She didn't want dinner or a movie. She was just fun and interesting, and even seemed interested in me. Every time I gained a bit of confidence, I'd see Evan behind her, shaking her head like I was a stooge. Finally, Christine said it was time to go. I walked her to her Corvette, swapped numbers, and we agreed to go out again. Then I came back to drink some more. Evan dressed me down. She'd essentially spent the entire date with us without Christine's knowledge. She made me feel like an idiot, but conceded that she thought it was a huge success. I eventually stumbled home, but not before stopping to feed the kittens. Across the street, just past the 7-Eleven, we'd found a litter of kittens that were living behind the trees in front of an empty house. Now it became tradition to buy a bag of cat food on the shuffle back to the apartment and hang out for a minute petting the kittens. I still think animal shelters should be open an hour before last call and right next to a bar, or even in the bar. Adoptions would quadruple. That night, I was love-struck, drunk, and giddy. I lay down with the kittens, shit-faced and beaming. I thought I might even sleep there in the small cluster of trees. A car full of Mexicans pulled out of the 7-Eleven and up to the curb. One guy got out and walked into the trees where I was laying down. He started to take a piss and, unknowingly in the dark, was pissing directly on me. When I made my presence known by vaguely rustling, he just said, "Don't move." He probably thought I was a homeless guy and pissed all over me. I was in no condition to do anything about it. In fact, if I'd been sober and alert, I'd still be in no condition to do anything about it. When he got back in the car, I got up to leave. He drove off shrieking with laughter. "I fucking pissed all over you, dude." That is why I think all Mexicans are bad people and 2 out of 3 black women are men. That is also why I think all homeless people aren't homeless at all. They just fell in love with a wealthy starlet and decided to sleep in the bushes with stray animals to celebrate. I am a product of my environment. Becker was waiting up when I came home. Everything went perfectly. She was beautiful. She was rich and famous. She didn't seem to care that I was a drunk. She hung out at my bar for hours and wanted to see me again. And I was covered in piss from a Mexican gangbanger. The night was a complete success.
Director's commentary. Matt Becker is here. Do you remember that night?
Yeah, I remember that night because you were so giddy when you were leaving. And I went, "I hope it goes well." And then it went longer and longer. And I go, "Well, it probably went well."
We sat around like a couple of fuss budgets. I remember using that word last night just to use it.
Yep.
Going, "Well, where do I take her?"
But we were planning topics to talk about. I would say off her career because she knows it.
Jan and Marcia Brady getting ready for a big date.
And then I waited up to see how it went. And it got later and later. As you know, I can kill time anywhere. But when you came home, you're all giddy, and then he told me about being peed on by a Mexican, and he still seemed happy. He had cat hair and pee all over him. I go, "I assume the date went well."
And now back to the book. Around this time, I'd started up a correspondence with a Florida death row inmate. He'd placed an ad in the LA Times classifieds in the pen pal section. I loved and still love reading the newspaper in the morning with a cigarette. It makes you feel like you're actually doing something. And unlike the internet, the newspaper eventually ends, so you know you have to get on with your day, even if you have to get down to reading classified ads out of boredom. His ad read, "Death row inmate, 35, white male, 6'3", 185 pounds, answers all correspondence, with the name Victor Farr and an address in Rayford, Florida. I sent a letter that read, "Dear Victor, I saw your ad in the LA Times and was intrigued, more so with the fact that you included your height and weight. You're on death row, for God's sakes. Did you think someone wouldn't write to you because you're a bit too chunky? If you're going to include your height, why not just say you're a 3'9" midget looking for a fat girl to smuggle you out of prison in her ass? At least that way your mail would be more entertaining. I included my name and address, but didn't expect a response. A week later, I get a reply thanking me for the letter. He said that I had no idea how important and rare it was to be able to laugh in a place like death row. That's all I needed to hear. The biggest payoff you get from doing comedy isn't on stage. It's from making people laugh unexpectedly and when they really need a laugh that's the most rewarding. A frustrated waitress or a store clerk laughing is way more gratifying than a paying audience. It's the difference between a girl blowing you because she likes you versus blowing you for money. You don't critique a free blowjob. You're just grateful for the courtesy. I wrote to Victor for several years. At some point early on, I asked him to keep those letters and send them back to me when they built up. This way I could keep them as a de facto diary that otherwise I'd be too lazy to write myself. Those letters are a large portion of the reason I was able to piece together some of these years for this book. He sent me his picture. I'd bring it with me whenever Christine would bring me to functions where there were going to be famous people. I'd ask him very politely if they'd mind taking a picture with my retarded brother's photograph. He's a big fan and he couldn't be here, you know, because he's retarded. Stars can't say no to retards. It's part of an oath, I think. Christine could get us in anywhere, invitation not necessary. She made a sport of it, from Oscar parties to the American Comedy Awards. I got pictures of Victor with everyone from Weird Al and Dennis Rodman all the way up to Nicole Kidman and Winona Ryder. I don't know how popular you can be on death row, but I'm sure that couldn't help but boost Victor's reputation. The thrill of dating a famous chick, and a beautiful one at that, wore thin quick. My jealousy was palpable. We'd walk down the red carpet at a premiere and photographers would yell out for her to pose. "Thanks, yeah, but could we get a single?" would invariably follow a polite way of saying, "Hey, Mr. Nobody, get the fuck out of the shot." It all shit on my newfound ego. I was supposed to be the up-and-coming talent here. Her show ended 6 years before. Since then, she'd done straight-to-video classics like Scanner Cop 2 and Cyborg 3 The Recycler. I was the one now getting all the meetings and the auditions. I was getting spots on TV, goddamn you. But anytime I was out with her, I felt invisible. She'd guest starred on a short-lived sitcom with veteran comedian Richard Jenny called Platypus Man. When he'd come into the improv, he'd hit on her like a viper. She'd always introduce me to him as her boyfriend and as a fellow comedian. He'd nod and go straight back to hitting on her. Later at the Montreal Comedy Festival, he was hosting a late-night show and introduced me, saying, "I haven't met this next guy, but I've heard a lot of good things." I opened with, "You haven't met me? You met me a dozen times when you were hitting on my chick right in front of me at the Improv in L.A. and then continued hitting on her after you knew it was my girlfriend." Now that I've been doing comedy as long as he had back then, I not only understand hitting on other people's girlfriends, but I'm also certainly aware of not remembering shit. I love it now when I'm out on the road and someone starts a story about crazy shit we did in days gone by, and even though I'm part of the story, I'm as interested as anyone else at the table in finding